welcome back to another episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees. I'm a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader. And we have a special guest this episode that I am thrilled and honored to introduce. Mark Evanier is a writer and director who has worked on TV programs such as Welcome Back, Kotter, many Hanna-Barbera cartoons we all know and love, The Garfield Show. He's written countless comic books, including the long-running Gru the Wanderer series with artist Sergio Aragonés. He also writes a terrific blog at newsfromme.com. That's my first stop every morning. And as one of his first jobs, he was an assistant to the great comic book creator Jack Kirby, who in 1940 conceived Captain America with writer Joe Simon, went on to create or co-create some of Marvel and DC's most popular heroes, including the Fantastic Four, Iron Man, the Hulk, the X-Men, DC's fourth world characters like Mr. Miracle and Darkseid. And in 2008, Mark wrote a terrific biography titled Kirby, King of Comics for our mutual publisher Abrams. So he is the Kirby expert. Welcome, Mark. I hope I got most of that right.
Yes, I would make one slight point here. I don't write Gru the Wanderer and have Sergio draw it. We write it together, just as Simon and Kirby wrote together. It was the question of one did writing and one did drawing. It was two guys who did each other's jobs or did the same job or whatever. Other than that, you got everything perfect.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Now, ostensibly, we're here to talk about the second minute of this movie. So, Jim, you want to break that down for us?
Yeah, well, not a lot much going on in this particular minute. We see a man in a parka holding a metal pole with a red light on top, and he waves down a truck, asks the fellows in the truck, "Are you from Washington?" And they said, "Well, do you get many visitors out of here?" And he said, "Not really." So they keep talking about a Russian oil team that found this strange thing under the ice. And the men coming in wanted to know how long it would take to get a crane in there to pull whatever it is out of the ice. And the man who had met the truck said, "I don't think you understand. You guys are going to need one hell of a crane." And as the minute ends, we have the camera pulling back to show a very large aircraft wing sticking out of the ice with a string of red lights showing an outline of a very large plane under the ice. That's the end of minute two.
All right. Thank you for that, Jim. Mark, I'd love to talk about Jack Kirby. So let's get some basics out of the way. When did you work for Mr. Kirby, and what was he working on then?
I was hired by Jack Kirby in February of 1970. He was doing the last of his work for that stint at Marvel, the last few Fantastic Fours and Thors and things he was doing for them. And I had nothing to do with those at all. And he was getting ready to, this was about a month before he quit Marvel to go to sign his DC contract. So my then partner, Steve Sherman, and I sat on that secret for a month. We knew this, a story that would rock the comic book industry when it came out. We just sat there for a month, keeping our lips sealed. And then when Jack started working for DC and doing it for them, Steve and I participated in what at the time seemed important, but in hindsight were kind of meaningless ways. Jack didn't need assistance. He wasn't at that point sure how much DC was going to let him do. And it turned out they didn't let him do as much as he wanted to do. So he didn't really need us that much. We participated in some of his comics. And I was working with Jack for a couple of years there. And then when it became really obvious that he didn't need one assistant, let alone two, I stepped aside and Steve did this stuff without me because I was busy with other projects at the time.
Now, you were just a kid at the time, right?
In 1970, I was 18 years old.
Fantastic. So what was the day at the office like? Where did you work? What did you do?
Well, Steve and I worked at my house during the week. Jack would give us assignments. We'd work on this stuff here. And then we'd go out to Jack's house, which was about a 45 to 60 minute drive, depending on the traffic.
And this was down in L.A., right?
Yeah, well, we were in L.A. and Jack was up in Thousand Oaks. And we drive out there and we'd spend the day there. Sometimes we'd go back and spend 2 days of the weekend there. Once in a while, we'd go out there in the middle of the week. But we weren't reporting to an office every day. we were, and we did a lot of stuff over the phone. Jack would call us to say, do this or that and such. He was an hour's drive from us. And again, there wasn't that much for us to do sometimes. So a lot of it was, this was keeping him company, hearing stories. Jack loved to tell stories, helping him out with, you know, some things which in hindsight seem kind of trivial.
You did the odd lettering and inking, I think, didn't you? Or was that more bullpen stuff?
That's kind of bullpen stuff. The comics, the lettering and inking, DC initially insisted be done in New York. Mm-hmm. And the lettering was done by a man named John Costanza, and inking was done by a man named Vince Coletta. Jack became unhappy with the inking he was getting and with the whole fact that that much of the work was done out of his sight. He was ostensibly the editor of the books, but he really wasn't, because he didn't see the stuff before it went to print. And he couldn't approve things, or if he disapproved of things, they sent him to press anyway against his wishes. So after a while, he was convinced by myself and Steve and a few other people that he needed to rein this in, and replaced the letterer and the inker we had with a man named Mike Royer, who lettered and inked the stuff. And Mike Royer was living in Whittier at the time. So again, we weren't like reporting to an office. Jack would mail the stuff to them, or sometimes I would take the work home and Mike would come to my house as a halfway point between his place and Jack's. And, it was just very kind of a loose range, working arrangement. Comic books, you know, are not generally written and drawn in the office. The editorial work is done in the office, but most of them are done at home. I write comic books sitting at this computer all the time, right here.
Yeah.
Miles from the publisher.
I think, especially growing up like I did as a Marvel kid, read Marvel books in the 70s, I always had this vision of the Marvel bullpen being a place where all the artists and all the writers were there. It was just this tumultuous party, atmosphere going on. It was nothing like that.
It was a tumultuous place. And I visited that office many times, and people were all running around crazy trying to get the books out. But the key writing and drawing was not done there. This was a matter of taking the stuff in, trafficking it. They did a lot of production work, pasting up letter pages, correcting artwork, sometimes even artwork that needed it. It was a crazy place. And there were a few people who were saying they're trying to write and draw stories or fix things up or whatever. But for the most part, Joe Sinnott, who inked an awful lot of Jack Kirby's work over the years, never inked one panel of it in the Marvel office. And he visited the Marvel office about once every 14 years. he was living in upstate New York, and he probably could have gotten there in a 90-minute train ride. The work was done at home. He did. There was nothing for him to do. No reason for him to come in. He worked at home.
Mark, go ahead, Brian. Just a quick question for you. Growing up, if I'm doing the math right, you're a kid in the late 50s into the 60s. Were you a comics fan before you found yourself working with one of the all-time greats at 18?
I tell people that when I was born, the doctor slapped me and I dropped a copy of Walt Disney's Comics and Stories. As far back as I can remember, I always had more than anyone else I knew. I collected everything, starting with the funny animals, but working my way into the superheroes. And I was fascinated by the business. I did not that really expect to work in it, because every time I read an interview with people who worked in comics, and there weren't very many of them as I was growing up, they all said, well, you got to live in New York. Yeah, and I didn't want to live in New York. And I also had aspirations to write for television, which I was living in Los Angeles. You don't go to New York to try to write for television, so I knew at a very early age, like 6 or 7, I wanted to be a writer. I wasn't sure what I wanted to be a writer of or what I could be a writer of. So my attitude growing up was, well, let's see what's viable. Maybe I can get into comic books. And I wouldn't think about comic books too much. Maybe I can get into animated cartoons, which I knew were produced in LA. Maybe I can get into TV writing situation comedies, which I knew were produced in LA. As it turns out, there were comic books being produced in LA. There was a company called Gold Key that had an office out here that was doing half their line. And I wound up working for them in 1971, 72, 73. And I can't explain to you why at an earlier age, I didn't think to go to work for Gold Key, try to get to it in there. It was kind of an accident that I got into working for them. But I got into writing comic books partly because Jack Kirby moved to Southern California from New York. And because also the business was having to kind of starting to migrate out here a little bit. And it was helped more later when they invented Federal Express and internets and things like that. But I kind of got into comics by accident.
So I swear to God, I'm going to let the other guys talk, but Kirby died in 1994 at the age of 76, which was a full decade before the Marvel Cinematic Universe got rolling. You've written before that Kirby foresaw something like the MCU becoming an enormous worldwide success decades before anyone else, that these characters had the potential to just go big. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, Jack had many, many incredible qualities. And if you think I'm exaggerating, watch an interview with anybody else who knew him. You'll see this, and they'll say the same thing. He was a visionary. Some people didn't get that because he talked with a Brooklyn accent or a New York accent at least. And he also had a tendency to start talking about A, and suddenly he's talking about B, and then he's suddenly talking about R, and then he's suddenly talking a little bit more about B. He jumped around topics which some people couldn't quite keep up with. His brain was operating full throttle every minute, and he jumped from topic to topic. And there were times when he'd say something to me, and I'd say, "Hey, that sounds great, Jack," and I had no idea what he was talking about. And then about an hour later, I go, "Oh, okay, I get it now." He was finishing up that other thread of conversation from yesterday or something like that. Very brilliant man, and he was a visionary in many ways. And one of the reasons he did not get his due in the comic book business is because he was working for people who simply did not know what he was giving them and the value of. He would say to the people who ran Marvel, "The day's going to come when these comic books will be bigger than James Bond." And they would like giggle behind his back that he was demented and deny him $5 raises. They never understood him. Not all, but most of the predictions Jack made in his lifetime, which sounded wacky at the time, came true. The one I cite often is that when the San Diego Con started, what we now know as Comic Con International, down in San Diego, he was a guest at the very first one. I've been to every Comic Con in San Diego. And the convention at that point, the first one had 300 people at it. I think the next one had about 1,000 or something like that. And then they kind of sneaked up to maybe 3,000 attendance for over the 3 or 4 days. And we thought that was as big as, that sounded pretty big. That's as big as it could get. And Jack would say, no, this is going to get bigger and bigger. And he said, and this is almost a verbatim quote, if not exactly, "The day is going to come when we'll take over this town. All of San Diego will be about the Comic-Con. And this is where Hollywood will come to sell the movies they made last year to find out what they're going to make next year." And we kind of went, "Okay, Jack, fine." Yeah, we had no perspective to see how often he would be right. And he was right. He was absolutely right. And the convention, I don't know how many of you guys have been to the comic convention in the last few years. It's the size Jack thought it would be. It's full of things other than comics, which Jack thought it would be. It's got Hollywood figuring on the Comic-Con as a major part of their marketing campaign for movies and their hunt for new properties for the future, as Jack thought it would be. And the other thing that's amazing when you go to the convention, you look around, if you're in the dealer's room, which I generally avoid these days, but I'm sure it hasn't changed. If you look around, you see Jack Kirby everywhere. Not only do you see characters he designed, but you see people trying to draw like him. You see an energy that is distinctly, to use a weird adjective, Kirby-esque. I see his influence everywhere I turn. And I tell people, if he wasn't your favorite artist, he was probably your favorite artist's favorite artist.
Yeah.
So many people. And after he died, and I keep appreciating him more and more with each passing year as I see the reach of his imagination. After he died, I had people coming to me who never got a chance to meet Jack or who never got a chance to say to him the expression of gratitude they had for what he brought to their lives. And they were looking for some place to dump that gratitude and make a contact. And I was the recipient by proxy of all that. People would say to me, "I wanted to shake your hand because your hand shook Jack Kirby's hand." And they would tell me stories about how Jack influenced them. And it wasn't just they became a comic book artist. There were guys who became film directors or all sorts of every creative field. There was a guy, I swear to you, who wrote me after Jack died that he was having trouble coping with the accepting the fact that there was a world now with no Jack Kirby in it. He'd never met Jack, but Jack had inspired him greatly in his chosen profession, which was, I swear to you, spot welding. Jack had inspired him to be a better spot welder. And I can't recreate it for you, but there was an explanation there that almost made sense to me. It had to do with giving 110% in the things you did and looking at something and say, how do I take this to the next level? Which is what Jack always did. One of the things that is true of all those comics you named that Jack started and the 95 others you could have mentioned was that they all led to other books. There were spinoffs and their characters introduced in the Fantastic Four who later came back in their own comics. There were villains in the New Gods who later had dolls out. I mean, it's amazing the reach. Very few of the things Jack ever did were only one issue or one series or whatever. They all led to other things, sometimes by Jack, sometimes by other people. And I'm talking too much.
No, not at all. Your mention of Comic-Con, I just want to interject that I have been to a few of them over the past years. I missed the most recent one, but if you saw any news footage or YouTube footage of this past Comic-Con, all you saw was that guy dressed as a 12-foot Galactus. And Kirby created Galactus 60 odd years ago. And the fact that, this character dominated Comic-Con and dominated a brand new Fantastic Four movie, it's just extraordinary. So, Jim, please go ahead.
Yeah, my question, I was wondering, Mark, something that I've heard about Kirby and his relationship with Stan Lee in turning Marvel into the powerhouse that it became was the idea of taking the old EC comics and things like that, where there were monsters and all kinds of horror things. And Kirby's idea, if I'm understanding it correctly, was to take the monster and make him a hero, such as the Hulk, all these terrible things that befell the heroes. The Human Torch was the second incarnation of the Human Torch was a hero, and the Hulk, he was kind of an anti-hero, but also a hero. Do you subscribe to that Kirby's change from making what would normally be a monster plot to be a hero as one of his secrets of making Marvel the success it was?
I don't buy that completely. The way I look at it, Jack was this enormous creative guy. People always would say to me, what was Jack's favorite comic to do? And the answer was anything. He was happy doing Westerns. He was happy doing war comics. He was happy doing romance comics. He and Joe Simon invented romance comics. There were certain things he thought were more saleable at given times. The superheroes came out of Marvel because Jack thought that it was the right time for superheroes in the marketplace. That was a strong belief of his. As far as the monster comics turning into the superhero comics, in effect, if you're asking about, yeah, there was some of that. War comics turned into superhero comics too. So Nick Fury started out as a war comic and turned into kind of a superhero. I think that there was, Jack took everything that you handed him and took it to another level. If you said to Jack, if the publisher had said, who was paying Jack to draw stories, said, I want comic books about, stuttering penguins. Jack would have taken, he might have said, that's not a commercial idea, but if you insist on it, Jack would go home and do something brand new with stuttering penguins that nobody would ever think of before. And he took it as a challenge, a personal challenge. A lot of times, he took a lot of bad ideas and turned them into good ideas at times. And he took, I think the genesis of the Marvel superheroes was that Jack was there. And the monster comics they were doing were dying. And Jack felt they should go in another direction. There is something to what you just said. But I think the larger picture, to use the term Jack always used, the big picture, was the term he used about the big picture, was that Jack was saying, we got to invent new comics for a new era, and the country is changing, the music is changing, the movies are changing. We've got to come up with something different and not just keep doing the stuff we're doing because the publisher thought it sold in 1951. And so he took, whenever they, I mean, he even took some of the Western comics and added an extra level of Kirbyization to them. I don't want to keep turning Jack into an adverb or an adjective. But he did take everything and try to turn it into something more exciting and interesting.
I have to tell you that my childhood has been wrecked because when I was a kid, my parents both worked in various places in New York City, and we'd go into Manhattan on the weekends and go down Madison Avenue, and I know 635 Madison Avenue was Marvel and 485 Madison Avenue was Mad Magazine. And I kept picturing, well, they're not working on today because it's Monday through Friday, and that you could just walk into the office. And although that wasn't the way things were, that was the persona that was coming through on all the pages, that you thought, well, there's a bullpen upstairs. They're all sitting around chewing on ink pens and thinking about what they're going to come up with next.
What year are you talking about here?
That would be the late 60s, early 70s.
Okay, I'll disillusion you of something here.
Okay.
The building you thought Marvel was in was not the building Marvel was in. The publishing company part of it was in the building with the address in the comics.
Yeah.
The editorial things, Stan Lee, the bullpen, John Romita, they were a block away in another building.
See, I would have gotten on the elevator and
been so disappointed.
But I will tell you a quick story here. In the summer of 1970, now that we were Jack Kirby's assistant, Steve Sherman and I flew to New York for the July 4th. It was my first comic convention. Was a New York comic convention that took place the July 4th weekend. So the week before, we flew to New York, and we could visit DC because we were Jack Kirby's assistant. We were working on DC projects, and I knew a lot of people up there. And we could visit Marvel because at the time, we were both working for the company that did the Marvel merchandising in LA, and it was doing this, selling posters and decals, occasionally delivering what people ordered, but not always.
So you were the Mary Marvel Marching Society, yeah, weren't you?
I founded the ranks. I came up with the ranks of the Mary Marvel Marching Society. So QNS and our real for years, every time Stanley would introduce me to everyone, he would not talk about the fact that I was writing television shows and for stand-up comedians and even comic books. He'd say, now this is the young man who invented the ranks of Marveldom. And that was to him my most impressive contribution, and to most people too to this day.
Sorry to derail, please go ahead.
Anyway, so on Monday of that week, we spent Monday at the DC Comics offices, which is magic. I met Julia Schwartz and Neil Adams and Carmen Infantino and all those people whose comics I grew up on. So the next day we were supposed to go meet Stan Lee at the 10 o'clock appointment. And about 9:30, we're about to leave the hotel. We're all dressed up, you know, even shaved and showered, and to go meet Stan Lee. And Stan's secretary calls us and says, Stan's got some emergencies to deal with. Come in today at 2 o'clock instead. So now it's like ordered at 10. We have no place else to go. So we decided to just walk down Madison Avenue. And we walked over to Madison and we started walking down Madison, which is a fascinating, one of the busiest streets in the world, with enormous traffic and huge trucks. And every place you went, there were street corners of people selling odd smelling food and things like that. And we get to one corner, just as we're sightseeing, and I suddenly hear someone yell, "Mi amigos!" I go look around, and a catty corner across the intersection, one of the busiest intersections in the world, is Sergio Aragones. He has recognized me from our two or three meetings in Los Angeles. I didn't know Sergio that well. I did him briefly a couple of times. And then he's in the street corner and he spotted us across. I'm amazed he recognized us or remembered me across that. We go over to see Sergio and he goes, "Mi amigos, glad to see you. You're in New York." "Hey, yes." And so we're going to the comic convention. And that we went to DC Comics yesterday. We're going to go see Stan Lee this afternoon. And he says to us, "Are you going to visit the offices of Mad Magazine?" And that had never occurred to us. I loved Mad Magazine. I had a complete collection of Mad Magazine. Mad Magazine was one of the most important things in my life I ever read. And it had not dawned on me, just as it hadn't dawned on me the Gold Key Comics is in LA, to visit Mad Magazine. I said, no, where are the offices? He says, right here, you're standing in front of them. And he took us in, and we walked into the, and we were going into the office. As we're walking in, this little sad-faced man with a portfolio, an artist, obviously, is walking out. And I went, that's Wally Wood. And we go in, and we meet Al Feldstein and Bill Gaines and Nick Meglin. And Angela Torres was there that day. And I'm thinking, what is Angela Torres doing here? He doesn't draw for Mad. Well, he did. He had just turned in his first job, and it hadn't been printed yet. So he had joined in the Mad crew there at that point. Wow. And we spent the morning meeting the Mad magazine people and stuff like that. And at one point, Sergio says, I will show you something that would interest you. And he goes to this big flat file, you know, that they store artwork in the art department. He pulls out a big pile of artwork, and he puts it in my hands and says, here, you may look at this, but you may not keep it. And it's the original art to Mad Magazine number one.
Oh, my gosh.
Number one, the Harvey Kurtzman, Wally Wood, Jack Davis. And I said to him, if I had a gun, I could keep it. And I stood there for maybe half an hour, these tables they had, the work tables, and just studied the original art to Mad number one. All the little pencil marks, all the little corrections, all the little details, all this tiny little stuff that never printed, or, you know, you'd even with a magnifying glass, you couldn't have found it in the printed comic, but it was there in the original art. It was the closest to a religious experience I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
And then that afternoon, we went to, to the Marvel offices and met Stanley. And then the rest of the trip, we spent our time commuting between the Mad Magazine offices, not the Mad, we didn't know. We didn't go back to Mad. We went back to DC a couple of times. We went to Marvel a couple of times. We went and spent 2 days with Steve Ditko in his studio. And then we went to the comic convention. And between all those places, I met just about everybody who wrote or drew a DC or Marvel comic I loved as a kid.
That's quite a day when meeting Stanley is the anti-climax of the day.
Yeah, Stan was colorful.
Yeah.
And I had a long history with him after that. You know, it's just like the day I first met Jack, I didn't realize this man is going to change your life, and you're going to spend, you know, hundreds and hundreds of hours with him and working with him and talking about him and getting involved with his family. I you know, things like that.
You know, many of the things people love about Steve Rogers and Captain America were created by Jack Kirby. And I think near the top of that list are Steve's sort of unshakable sincerity and integrity. I suspect Kirby was much the same.
Jack was a wonderful guy. I have to, and I'm going to make this correction every time. Captain America was created by Joe Simon and Jack Kirby.
Right.
Now, and there's some, you know, they remember differently who created what. And I have my own opinions because I knew both men, Jack more than Joe, but I certainly knew Joe and spent a lot of time with him. A lovely man. They were both guys who had the idealism of youth, especially during the time when, you know, the country seemed to be coming apart, when World War II was looming there and eventually burst out. They were living in an era where you woke up every morning, you went, my God, what is happening to the world? Thank God it isn't like that these days.
He says, ironically.
and they were both idealistic in those regards. Jack was a very nice man. He was a very decent man. He was completely honest. He got confused a lot. There's an interview with Jack where he got things wrong. And I discovered sometimes he would tell me a long story about Captain America. And I realized he got one word wrong. He's talking about Captain Marvel. if you could make that correction in your head, everything else made sense. Occasionally he'd get things out of sequence and things like that. Like I said, his mind kept jumping around all the time. Yet he was able to infuse his comics are infused with a great deal of energy and positivity and emotion. I see Jack in an awful lot of the comics he did, particularly the New Gods books, the books he did for DC, where he wrote and drew without anybody tampering. Well, they occasionally tampered with his work, but somebody changing it. And every so often I will reread New Gods in its entirety. Because DC reprints it about every 20 minutes now. and I'll suddenly go, oh, wait a minute, that's Jack talking about referencing this experience in his life. Why didn't I see that the first 32 times I read this? You know, it's like the books sit there on my shelf. That my Kirby shelf is over there. You can't see it right now. This used to be my Kirby shelf, but it's now the Charles Schulz shelf because I have a book I worked on. So I have, we swapped the Kirby books and the Peanuts books in the room. But I look at the Kirby shelf and I just feel good about it, particularly about the fact that when he did the New Gods, DC gave up on it way too early. The sales figures were fine. DC, I have very low respect for the people who ran DC at that period. I mean, they did somewhat of things creatively, but they gave up on every comic they tried too fast, and then they blame the artist or the writer for the book, you know, only lasting 3 issues. No, it lasted 3 issues because you cancel it after 3 issues. And I'm so proud of the fact that that book has an audience today that I can look over there and see that maybe 5 different versions of the New Gods reprinted in fancier. They keep bringing it out in more expensive editions with fancier paper and less coherent forwards by me. And I'm so happy about that. And I love reading those books and just spending those hours with Jack, because he's all throughout. And there's a, in a way that, you know, there's a lot of creative people, a lot of wonderful writers and artists in comics. And I don't think any of the ones I have in mind, even though I won't say their name, would be offended when I say they're not as visible in their comics as Jack was in his. I can look at certain comic books written and drawn or written or drawn by people I knew well, and I don't see as much of them in those comics as I do of Jack in terms of the integrity of the characters, the, you know, in Orion, the character New Gods, the character of the New Gods book, there's a balance there between doing the right thing heroically and doing the right thing for your family and the people around you. They don't always the same thing. Jack, over in his life, had to make certain compromises and take jobs he didn't want because his number one mission in life was to provide for his family. And you cannot understand Jack Kirby. You do not understand that about there was nothing more important than making sure that his wife and kids had a house, had groceries, had a dental plan, had, you know, the basic kids could go to school, had the basic necessities of life. And he was not the only guy who grew up in the Depression who had that attitude. My father had that same attitude. Everybody Jewish guy I knew in that, and not just Jewish people, but every Jewish person I know in that age group, that was the driving force behind these people who grew up in the Depression. I've got to make a family and I've got to feed them well and take care of them. So, you notice how I am. I'm answering lots of questions.
Yeah, no, it's
that's fantastic. I hear a lot of, you know, my father was a child of the Depression, you know, not of Jewish persuasion at all, but that was very much his attitude as well. You could just see it in everything he did was that constant drive to just make sure the basics were covered and make sure that we had enough.
Yeah. Well, Kirby, you know, he grew up in the Depression. He was also part of that generation of writers and artists who served in World War II. You know, they'd seen real combat. They understood what it was like to fear for their lives. And I think that gives all of their writing and artwork an energy or a verisimilitude or something, some energy that other work doesn't. And particularly when you're talking about Captain America, I think Kirby's work on Captain America carries more weight because Kirby actually fought Nazis in Europe, like Captain America did.
You know, well, he fought, they started Captain America before he did that.
Right.
the World War II was, and this is probably true of everybody who saw combat action, but it was an important moment in Jack's life. He had nightmares about it every night of his life practically. And it informed his work and informed his life. You know, I can write a story tomorrow about, you know, people saving the world, heroes saving the world. But I'll let you know a secret. I've never saved the world. I've never participated meaningfully in saving the world. Jack was in, you know, Normandy. I mean, he had, you know, he was one of those guys, and he knew those guys, and he lived with those guys, and he loved those guys, and it was a very big turning point in his life. Not a lot of the war comics that were produced over the years were done by people who'd seen action in the military. Even after, you know, they were done by World War II veterans, a lot of them were, you know, artists would stay in this country and work for the Stars and Stripes or you know, paint signs and things like that. You don't go through a situation like that and not have it affect the rest of your life. And if Jack were here right now and you asked him a question about World War II, the rest of this podcast would be World War II stories, whether you liked it or not. Endless stream of them. There was a comic book artist named Doug Wildey, a good friend of mine. And whenever Doug walked into a room at a convention or one of our club meetings, and he saw Jack sitting there, he'd go, "No World War II stories, no World War II stories." And Jack would just start it on him, and you couldn't stop. And they were good stories too, but you know, some of us wanted to hear about, you know, about the Hulk.
Do you think we're getting close to the end of our session here? But do you think that Jack Kirby would have enjoyed the MCU the way it's going out to the public?
So what, the Marvel
Cinematic Universe?
I think it would depend on if he got any money off and proper credit and recognition. Jack was very proud of the work he did and very felt he was undercredited and underpaid. And that's not a secret. An awful lot of people in comics were undercredited and underpaid. It was not a business where the rewards were always commensurate with the effort and the accomplishment. I would like to think that if Jack had lived a little longer, people would have come throwing money at him to design not only Marvel movies, but movies a la Marvel. They'd come to him and give him, let him create things, and that he would have profited. Stan Lee made a hell of a lot of money because he was Stan Lee. Jack Kirby died before he could make a hell of a lot of money for being Jack Kirby. That's one of the problems here. It's something I feel emotional about at times. And he deserved an awful lot more. So the answer, if Jack had, gone to see a Thor movie or a Captain America movie or any of things, first of all, he'd be sitting there saying, "Yeah, I knew it. I knew it." But also, that's what he said when he saw Star Wars. It was all, he looked at that and he said, "Those are all ideas I came up with." And it's, he's right. He was right. But he also would have said, "I wish they would have let me fix this or do this or whatever," because Jack looked at what he did as directing movies on paper. He felt you could take a lot of his comic books and use them as a storyboard and shoot a movie. It would not take a lot of add-ons. Use it as the basis, expand on those, you know, what happened between panel one and panel two, but put in panel one and panel two and so on. And you can see in some of the movies I've seen, I haven't seen a lot of the Marvel, I've seen one of the Marvel movies, but I've seen examples where people show me a panel, a scene from a movie, and I go, "Well, that's out of Jack's this issue of Thor or this issue of the Avengers," like that. Somebody saw that. So did I answer your question?
Yes, yes, you did, Mark. I really, I can't tell you how comprehensive this particular episode, and we're only two episodes in now. This is our second episode, and this is exactly what we're trying to promote in this entire series.
But I may have too much experience talking about Jack Kirby. you can see the glee I have in talking about him. I love the man, and I love talking about him, and I feel like I had a special vantage point that I want to share with those who didn't have.
So thank you for sharing that with us.
Much appreciated. Wow. I'd like to also thank our audience for joining us. If you'd like to continue our conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at a podcast streaming service wherever you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. So be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.